Welcome to Outspoken, where we dive deep into the topics and intersection of technology, money, business, and passion. I'm your host, Shayna Cosgrove.
When you come from a difficult background, in your mind, you don't want to ever have to experience the things that you've experienced in that environment ever again. So when you have that on your mind, you're completely focused on, hey, I'm going to make a better life for myself. Really, what I was looking for was a challenge that could lead to a career where, you know, I didn't have to worry about, you know, some of the challenges that my family had. If you're saying that you want to do something and achieve something, it's all about habits. If you have the right habits where you're building up towards that goal and you're putting in the time and the energy and effort day after day after day, there's nothing that can stop you from that success that you want.
This podcast is sponsored by Nyla Technology Solutions, an SBA-certified 8A, HubZone, woman-owned small business specializing in full-stack software engineering and data science services to the U.S. government. Our innovative solutions are built to match the speed of mission. For more information, partnering opportunities, and new job openings, please visit our website, www.nyla.io.
How do you know Stephanie Beben? So we're connected through Stephanie. How do you know Stephanie?
So I was the chief of operations data science at NSA. So I ran all data science for the operations director. And she was my Booz Allen, you know, Hamilton kind of right-hand person that really, you know, supported me and everything that we did from building data science models to strategy. So she was like the person that, you know, I looked to for kind of advice and just understanding, like, what do we need to do next? Like, who do we need to hire? You know, who are the superstar people on the Booz Allen side that we need to bring in? So she was just that person. I know she's probably that same person.
She's absolutely amazing. And I think what's interesting is probably about during that time, the term data science wasn't as popular there as it is now, right? So it was like kind of this weird niche thing that you were doing. They were doing the work, but they weren't calling it that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, see. Applied mathematicians, and then you had a lot of the analysts that were kind of highly skilled in SIGINT, the SIGINT analyst. Now we call the citizen data scientist, but you know, the SIGDEV analyst in a sense. But yeah, it was the applied mathematician and the folk that were in R, you know, the research directorate that had the mathematical and theoretical statistical background and knowledge. And they were our, you know, quote unquote data scientists of today. You know, we recruited a lot of folk that had been through the Masters of Data Science programs, and we created this data science development program that
went now around. We hire from. It's a great program. Thank you for creating it.
I know Jaysha. I know her. She was actually in my organization as well.
Yeah, she's amazing. So tell me about where you are today. What's your day job?
So right now, I am CEO of AI Squared. AI Squared is a Silicon Valley startup where we were funded, you know, from New Enterprise Associates, top-tier VC. We were blessed to be, you know, one of the few startup organizations that have been funded by top-tier VCs that at the helm are Black or African-American. So it's really a great opportunity for us. So really, you know, my day-to-day focused on, you know, helping organizations understand the value in being able to bring in machine learning algorithms and integrate them into end-user applications. But I'm a CEO kind of running AI Squared, but I'm also currently a senior research scientist at Johns Hopkins University. There, I'm currently spearheading a lot of the risk model development. There's an application. Some of the folk out there may have used it. There's 4 million users currently that have utilized this COVID-19 risk tool that we developed at Johns Hopkins. There was a Nature paper that came along with that tool. But the point was, is that individuals needed a tool that could help assess their risk in regards to getting COVID-19, as well as if you're vaccinated, what's my risk according to the area that I live in? And what we use is a lot of data from the CDC that helped us understand what were the current vaccination rates in certain areas, you know, who are the people that were currently vaccinated in regards to like their genetic makeup, as well as, you know, things like in this geographical location, what's the density of people that have been vaccinated in this particular area? So we're pulling all that data, all that information, and you can put in your information and then we push out a score that can help you understand what the level of risk is for the current area that you currently live in for you to get COVID-19 as well.
Is it on their website? So where can we go find this?
Yeah, go to COVID-19risktools.com. You'll be able to get to the Johns Hopkins tool. And there are two different types of tools you can use. There's a risk map where you can basically put in your zip code and you can actually see what's the risk in that area according to your zip code, or according to the state or city. And then we'll generate a risk score for you as well.
Did they already have a risk modeling tool that you then had to modify specifically for COVID, or was this like from scratch specifically for COVID?
There was an effort at the start of the pandemic where a couple of the scientists in the organization were putting together a COVID-19 model, and they were generating that and creating a statistical model that didn't have an application interface. My job as the data scientist in the biostatistics department, as a research scientist, they come to me and say, "Hey, Dr. Harvey, we got this cool model that you can put in data and it's built in R, but we need an application that will enable, you know, the general population to put their information through a tool or through an application and then be able to get scores directly from that application instead of running an R script to be able to do the same thing." So that's when I built the actual application, and then we were able to kind of see exactly how the results of the, you know, the general population could be infused through a user interface, and then we're generating scores in that manner.
Was the relationship with the CDC already set up?
So basically, it's a set of statistics that are associated with different models that different universities have created. So basically, they'll give you a time frame. It'll be like 4 weeks, 6 weeks out, 8 weeks out. And basically, there's these different models from across these universities that are predicting, based upon the historical data and the amount of deaths per a given geographical location, they're running predictions. And what we're doing is we're taking the prediction data that's associated with the deaths that have happened in a certain geographical location, and we're using that as well as, you know, your personal behavior, whether you smoke, other information about, you know, height, weight, age, sex, all that information we're pulling, running through our model with the CDC death rates. And then that's how we come up with the risk score.
You were like the talk of Thanksgiving. Was everyone like proud of you, showing off your work? Like, that's my boy! <You know>? Kind of nerding out, but like, that's a big deal, right? Everyone was looking at Hopkins for the data rates, and then you've got the little score.
You know, everyone was referring to me as if I was the expert for COVID, right? And, you know, I was the one in the household who was trying to explain to everyone what to do and what not to do. It's kind of like the computer scientists that when you come home, they're asking you to fix their laptop, right?
And, yeah. And
like, guys, I do SIGINT analysis. For at that time, there were about 4 million users that had utilized that tool. I was able to kind of, you know, get it into the hands of my family members, that some of them were at a higher risk than others, so that they could better understand, hey, I need to be more careful because of my risk that, you know, I have in accordance to the data that's, you know, being pushed through this model and what we're actually being received from that actual tool. They were able to really kind of make decisions that were helping them in regards to some of the day-to-day activities that they were doing throughout that, you know, holiday break.
You have such an impressive resume and history. What's the family situation like? Is it all geniuses?
I have 5 brothers, the 6 of us total. 6 boys, 1 girl total.
Wow.
2 of my brothers are actually up here in the DMV area with me. 2 of them are retired military officers. So one brother retired as a captain and another retired as a major.
From Army?
From Army, correct. One of my brothers is, you know, an aspirational data scientist as well, just finished his master's over at American University in data analytics.
We're hiring. We're hiring. We have some great jobs just opened up.
Yes, ma'am. And we'll definitely push him your way as well. The other brother, he is you know, currently pursuing his PhD in cybersecurity. So we do have some technical chops in the family, but, you know, I was the first to, you know, graduate with my master's and the first to graduate with my PhD in my entire family. So they were extremely proud of me.
What did your parents do?
So my dad was a pastor in Jacksonville, Florida. He actually worked for AT&T.
Being a pastor wasn't his full-time job.
Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah. So he worked at AT&T for a long time. He was a project manager, program manager for AT&T. And my mother, she basically stayed at home and, you know, really helped think about raising the six boys and one girl in the family. And then she ended up getting her RNA and she's been doing nursing assistance for the past probably close to 10 years now.
That's a hard job.
Yes. Very difficult job.
Very different than like sitting in an office and sending like reminder emails to people. No offense, Dad. Yeah, my mom was a nurse. My dad was actually a project program manager as well. So I can very much relate. I'm sure I'm not the first person to tell you this. You come across as very driven and intense. Were you like that as a kid?
You know, I can remember when my parents did taxes and their income was like $13,000 and they were trying to take care of six kids, right? So we grew up in a very kind of, when it comes to, you know, amount of money, modest amount of money in the household where, you know, we were really focused on, you know, survival really, you know, at that point internally within our family. So there were a lot of challenges, you know, associated with growing up in an environment and in an area specifically where you think about the kind of socioeconomic challenges that are within some of these environments. And that's really the environment that I grew up in. It was a lot of killings. The schools that I, you know, went to and attended as a younger child were F schools. My background was full of challenges that built a lot of character, right? So coming out of high school, you know, I really didn't have a good understanding of, when you think about a lot of kids that, hey, they went to this camp and this camp introduced them to computer science, or they went to this particular club, you know, did robotics and things like that. So for me, it was really, let's figure out the major that you could go and have the best opportunity to make the most money. I went to Mississippi Valley State University, and really what I was looking for was a challenge, right, that could lead to a career where, you know, I didn't have to worry about, you know, some of the challenges that my family had faced when I was younger. So I was really focused on like, what could I do? Use my knowledge, just being a bright student growing up to be able to, you know, go into a college degree and being able to, you know, find something that would really enable me to, you know, come out making an amount of money that would eliminate some of the challenges that I faced when I was younger. You know, there I went into computer science, because at Mississippi Valley State University, that was the most challenging and difficult major that you could actually go after.
Where are you in your family lineup?
Out of the boys, there are six boys. I am number five of six.
Oh, so you're practically the baby. Where's your sister fall?
And she's the youngest.
Oh, she's the baby. Oh, this poor girl. Gotta give her a hug. So did any of your brothers go off to college too, right away?
There were the two brothers that ended up being military officers. Those were the two that ended up going off to college right away.
What kind of high school did you go to? Did you go to like a better high school, or was it still, you know, a rough high school?
So the high school that I went to, it was an F high school. And when I say F school, I mean by the standardized tests in Florida, it's called the FCAT. My junior and senior year, I transferred out of that school to go to a magnet program, which allowed me to get into more of an environment that was more conducive for learning.
How did you even know about applying to the magnet program?
We really didn't know anything about it. It was just my mom was trying to figure out how to get me out of the current school environment that I was in. So she started to ask around, hey, you know, Benjamin has good grades, high potential. You know, he's doing really well at this school, but there's just so many bad influences. How could we get him into a different school? And then they said, hey, you should apply to the magnet programs. The actual school itself was essentially known for its computer program, actually.
Oh, really?
So I was able to take, a couple of computer classes. And that's really honestly what made me think about, all right, if I do a degree, I want to do the hardest thing. And there was a couple of different options. You could do math, like pure math, or you could do, you know, like a computer science as well, right? So that's where I kind of, you know, had a little bit of understanding and knowledge.
What was the adjustment at the magnet school like for you?
Oh, it was a major adjustment, really. Coming from a school that's an F school and then, you know, having to adjust to a school that, you know, puts a lot of emphasis and energy on, you know, standardized tests and, you know, being able to test well. The real difference was, you know, the study habits that you had to pick up, because I was, you know, flying through, you know, the classes at the one school that I was before the magnet program. But coming into that program, you have to have certain study habits that would allow you to be successful in the testing that they had to prepare you for the standardized test. So
did you have a computer at the house?
I did not have a laptop until I graduated from college. So I was the guy that was in the computer lab till, you know, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, until they closed it, essentially, trying to get my schoolwork done, or borrowing my roommate's computer.
Did you have a flip phone?
I had a Nokia. If you remember the small Nokia phones that had the game Snake on them, that's it's close enough to a flip phone. It's close. Trust me, it is.
So did you get a scholarship at college?
I ended up playing football in college. So I got a football scholarship.
A full ride?
Yeah, full ride. I played both football and basketball.
Oh my God, really?
Yes. Yeah.
Were you the only computer science major playing a sport?
Yeah, I was the only. Actually, no, I'm sorry. We had one other computer science major that was playing sports. But everyone,
what sport was it? Was it fencing?
He was actually on the football team.
Really?
Yes. So we had a couple, but unfortunately, because of the rigor in, you know, sports, you're going to meetings in the morning, you're going to practice in the afternoon, you're going to weightlifting at night. And then after weightlifting, there's another meeting to watch film. So with the rigor and then the travel, right? There was one period when I played basketball that we were probably gone for an entire month out of school. Just traveling.
You didn't even have a laptop to work. Nowadays you could like maybe sit outside and run your models.
Yes.
Keeping everybody out. But then you had to wait till you got back, right?
Exactly. The thing about the sports is that there's a lot of emphasis and energy put on, you know, you have to be, you know, they call it a student athlete, but our coaches, they would beg to differ and they would call us athlete students, right? They would say, oh no, you're athlete first and then you're a student, right? So there's a lot of emphasis on that. But the point is that playing basketball in college, playing football in college, and being a computer science major, those things all together really helped me become the person that you see today that's doing CEO of AI Squared, but also as a research scientist at Johns Hopkins and a research professor at George Washington University.
You had to be so disciplined to succeed at all of that, right? You didn't just play one sport, you played two sports. And then I majored in computer science and I didn't play a sport. And I know how incredibly hard it was and how much work they piled on you. It was somewhat of a test to see, can you even just handle this workload? It's not even like other classes where we want to make sure you learn this knowledge. It's also like, can you handle this huge amount of problem sets and this amount of stress? Where did you gain that discipline and at such a young age when there's so many other temptations to not be like that?
When you come from a difficult background, you don't want to ever have to experience the things that you've experienced in that environment ever again. As far as, you know, going, you know, some days and you know, some nights and, you know, not having anything, you know, to eat sometimes, right? So when you have that on your mind, you're completely focused on, hey, I'm going to make a better life for myself and, you know, for my family when that time comes. So parties and the typical things that, you know, most students would do in college, I really didn't have an appetite for, because my mind and my energy was all focused on, you know, how can I help myself, you know, to be in a better situation, but also thinking about the kind of where you come from and the people that are still in that environment, right? You're thinking, all right, how can I help, you know, help my family? How can I help other individuals that are in similar situations as myself? How can I help my brothers and my sister? You know, having that mindset of being focused on helping others and not having to go back to that environment is really what kind of kept me focused and gave me that grit, those habits to be able to be successful.
How many years did it take you to graduate?
So it took me 5 years to graduate from undergrad.
And what made you decide to go off to Harvard instead of taking a big money job? They're recruiting all the computer science majors. They're dangling these offers in front of you, but you're like, nope, I want to go be a research assistant.
I actually did. I did a Harvard Medical School post-baccalaureate. So literally from Mississippi Valley State University, I went to Boston, Massachusetts, in the Cambridge, Massachusetts area. And I was at Harvard for about a year. There's a joint program, Harvard and MIT, Health and Science Technology Organization. And that was my first exposure to, you know, applying advanced analytics, statistical models to large-scale cancer genomics data sets, which I ended up in my dissertation taking all that knowledge from Harvard and, you know, the knowledge of working with some of the best in the field, like Vincent Carey, who's the creator of R Bioconductor. I was able to take that knowledge and apply it in my dissertation at Bowie State University for my PhD.
So you go from Harvard and you decide from there to go to Bowie?
Correct. Yep. So I went from Harvard for a post-baccalaureate to Bowie State University. And the reason that I went from the Boston area to the DMV area was for the National Security Agency job. I was hired into the Cryptologic Computer Science Development Program. And that's where I started my career at NSA. So while I was at NSA, I was going to school full-time at Bowie State University to get my PhD degree.
Oh, wow. So how did they come and recruit you? How did that happen?
You know, I honestly, my brothers were in the area. Actually, they were there. So they were military officers in the DMV area first. So I started to look for computer science opportunities in the DMV area. And I applied to NSA and, you know, the rest was history.
Did you know what it was before you applied?
I had no idea, no clue.
Did you start watching movies after that?
I sure did.
Goodwill Hunting?
Yeah, that's right. That's regression.
Goodwill Hunting came out. It's like your age, right? Like, did you relate to Goodwill Hunting?
Yeah, Goodwill Hunting. And I was watching Enemy of the State as well. I was watching those two movies, right? But yes, yeah, so that was part of it, correct.
So you apply, they clear you, and then you start, but they're paying you to go to Bowie.
Correct.
Yes. What a dream, huh?
Yes. Yeah, no, that was incredible.
So for 2 full years, you went to Bowie full time?
I did 3 years of the after hours program, which is, you know, go to school after hours. And then I did 2 semesters of the 2020 program, which is you get 20 hours a week. And that's when I was finishing up my dissertation.
Your PhD or for your master's?
PhD. So my master's and PhD was combined into 4 years that I went at Bowie State.
Where are you getting this like divining rod to say like, go pursue these high value things and do it with such kind of dedication? Because everyone else in the development programs, they're like largely chilling.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right.
I'm making some real money now. They're blowing it on an apartment. And they're getting through the development program and like meeting some girls. And you're like, nope, PhD.
Right, exactly.
Actually, work probably seemed really easy to you, didn't it? After like all of that school and work?
It was more of a challenge when I first started. As I worked through the PhD program, you know, even you kind of sharpen the knife even more, right? Because I was computer science undergrad. But when I really started to get into the PhD program and master some of those skill sets across, you know, computer organization, computer architecture, data structures, discrete structures, and computer programming. And then like, and at Bowie State University, you have to master those because they make you take a qualifier and a comprehensive exam. The qualifier exam is those 5 core courses that I just mentioned, and you have to master them. And then the comprehensive exam goes into your, you know, the field that you want to go in. And for me, it was machine learning and big data. So the point is, you know, after I really honed in on those core computer science areas, you know, it was a breeze at that point. But when I first started coming out of college, it was more of a challenge because it was just, it was a combination of both time and knowledge and learning the ecosystem at NSA. And then the other is really that core knowledge in those core areas of computer science.
So you spent 10 years at NSA. What was your favorite part about it?
I was the lead data scientist for the Snowden leaks, for the Edward Snowden leaks. So I worked for an organization called the Corporate Disclosures Action Group, CDAG. I worked there for about 2 years, and I was the lead data scientist responsible for helping the organization understand the equities that were in the data that was taken out of the building. So that was a really a highlight. And I won the ODNI award for counterintelligence. So that was a highlight of my career. And there was one other thing that I did where I was able to help support developing an application for disadvantaged students in Baltimore. Internally at the agency, we built an application that allowed you to walk a day in the life of a cybersecurity professional. The students in Baltimore that were in high school, middle school, they were able to select a persona. One of the personas was me. And then you could basically do different activities. And at the end, what they print you out is a cyber resume. You get the cyber resume. And then the cyber resume would be something that you could try to follow in order to become a cybersecurity professional at the NSA one day, right? So you look at, you know, the cybersecurity resume, it'll have, you know, taking these different, you know, cyber courses, cyber certifications, and possibly even getting a master's or a PhD in cybersecurity or computer science. So it was kind of helping them understand, you know, for a lot of the younger individuals in Baltimore that kind of looked like me, it helped them understand, hey, this is a person that is at the NSA right now that has been through some of the same experiences. And here's what he had to do to get there. And we'll help you understand what you would have to do to get in that position as well. So we did that. And for that particular effort, I was able to win the ODNI Award for Human Capital.
You've got it twice?
Yes. Yeah.
Can we go to the website now and see that program?
I think it had been decommissioned, unfortunately. But it was called Life's Journey, was the name of the application.
Yeah, I'm part of Fort Meade Alliance. I wonder if we could get it resurrected at all because, you know, there's a huge effort to not just for diversity, but there's going to be an extreme shortage of talent overall. And so they're going to have to find ways to help people who didn't have a traditional path, like they didn't go straight to college and they didn't get the appropriate degree, you know, as it exists today for engineering. So they're going to have to work with people who have a more non-traditional path. Yeah, it'd be great to see if we could resurrect it. I'm sure you know the right belly buttons to go poke about that.
Yeah, you know it. Yes, ma'am.
What made you decide to leave? That's a big deal, especially you were kind of mid-career. So people typically don't leave at that time. They leave closer to 4 years or they leave much later. What prompted you to start looking around?
There's technology that is definitely really cutting edge and innovative for the DOD and the federal government. It's top notch. It's the best thing since sliced bread for the internal classified environment that exists inside of that organization. But there's a lot of technologies that are open source, plus technologies that have been created internally inside of some of these Silicon Valley, you know, style startup organizations, or just like, you know, the 936 unicorn billion-dollar startups that are not IPO'd yet, that have all these amazing technologies that are pushing the fields of AI and machine learning and, you know, all the way through to, you know, big data and large scale distributed computing and analytics. They're pushing that, the knowledge forward. But when it comes to those cutting edge technologies that haven't been in the space for a long amount of time, a lot of the individuals within the organization, they really want to have access to that technology, right? And you really want to be able to use that on a day-to-day basis. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, when you're working in that classified environment, there's processes and procedures in order to be able to get some of that technology into the hands of the data scientist or the computer scientist that wants to be able to use it. So at the point in which you're really interested in seeing what are the innovative cutting edge technologies that exist outside of the agency, I think a lot of the younger data science development program interns and things like that that are in that space, they really have this itch to want to utilize these cutting edge novel technologies that are in the space on a day-to-day basis. So when you get that itch, it's kind of like, you know, General Nakasani is really focused on figuring out how to even enable folk that are in mission spaces to be able to do tours in industry and then come back. Because the point of the matter is that a guy like myself, I was interested in doing a tour in industry, but I didn't come back because programs like that don't exist. You want to start dealing with and exploring and utilizing, you know, that technology that you just don't have access to, especially on an academic level.
So what kind of company lured you away?
It was Databricks. Databricks was at the time the company that the founders of Databricks created Apache Spark. And Apache Spark was one of those technologies I was super interested in using. They had, you know, some technologies. One of them was called MLflow. They had some other technologies that Delta was one of them that really helped with providing like asset level transactions for big data.
Explain some of these words for people who aren't in the know. What is Apache Spark?
Yeah. So Apache Spark is...
He's got a big smile on his face, by the way. Yeah. Loves Apache Spark.
Yeah. So Apache Spark is basically, it's a next generation Hadoop technology, right? So
what is Hadoop?
If you come from spaces, Hadoop is the infrastructure for how all NSA data storage and analytics is done, right? So it's an open source technology, essentially. And Hadoop is the big data infrastructural technology that's used at the agency. But basically, it's a way to store data in key value pairs. It provides transparent access to a file system where the data is distributedly stored. So it basically has the attributes of parallelization. So you can parallelize your analytics. You can distribute it across commodity hardware. Parallel distribution and scalability. So you can scale up your analytics to add in more compute resources so that you can do more intensive compute across some of the large data sets that exist that are distributed in this Hadoop infrastructure.
So for all those nerds out there who are old like me, so for all the old people listening, you remember the search for extraterrestrials that you used to download and run on your computer when your computer was idle. That was the modern version of parallel computing, right? So they were trying to use as many computing resources as they have. They would aggregate the information. So that I'm relating it to all the more mature listeners in the audience. So Hadoop's old school and Spark is the latest and greatest. What's Spark do?
So one of the things that Hadoop was not efficient in was machine learning. And the reason for it is because there were a lot of read and writes to and from disk. Because if you think about it, there's all these distributed nodes that you've stored data on. And like the analytics paradigm of Hadoop was MapReduce. So basically, you chop up the analytic and you distribute it out to the different nodes. And then you run part of the analytic on different nodes. And then you reduce the results down to a single node. And then you compute the results that have been done across all these nodes in that cluster. So the problem with Hadoop for machine learning is that machine learning has a lot of forward and back propagation. If you think about neural networks, right? So you're going through this network, you're back propagating, doing calculations, going back through the network, back propagating. So there's a lot of read and writes to and from disk. It was really inefficient and not optimal at all in regards to being able to do machine learning with all the forward and back propagation across these nodes in a cluster using that paradigm, that MapReduce style paradigm in a sense, right? Spark created like in-memory, like this in-memory processing paradigm, which basically allowed you to allocate a big chunk of memory, push the data in, and then push your analytic into memory with the data. So instead of reading and writing to and from disk, you're doing this shared memory kind of model where you're sharing the memory, you're throwing as much data as you can and chunking it in memory with the analytic, processing as much as you can, and then using the results of that to, you know, distribute out to whatever end user.
Are you able to use the same size of data that you can for Hadoop? So could you take the same set and throw it in the same memory? Because now you're not spreading it across as many computers, right?
Exactly.
Or one virtual one?
That's right. You got it. You got it. 100%. That was the value. So similarly, how in Hadoop and MapReduce, the data was distributed out to the nodes, and each one of those nodes had a small amount of memory. What Spark was able to do is it was able to take advantage of the processors that have been created that are now having even more and more amounts of memory on each one of these processors. So you allocate a cluster that has a number of nodes, but each node has so many gigabytes of memory now. So basically, in that cluster, you're sharing that memory, and you take the data in this kind of shared memory, and you chunk it into that shared memory, and then you just run your entire machine learning algorithm in memory instead of having to run each one of the different activation units for that neural network on a single node and then try to process all that information.
So it was software that came based upon the evolution of the hardware architectures at the same time.
Exactly. You got it.
You said some other word like ACID. What is that?
So ACID transaction is really, think about like data warehouses. One of the knocks on content store is that if you think about content versus metadata, there's a lot of content that you can store that is basically, you know, like files and things like that. And when you're storing these large amount of files, you're able to store them in a way where, you know, you can kind of run a search and you can search directly for a particular file. And there's metadata associated with that file that you can access, and you can do a search. And then based upon that metadata, you can pull back the different files that you want. If you think about it, for metadata, think about like all the metadata that you would probably see in an enterprise organization. That metadata usually is stored within the data warehouse. And for those data warehouses, you are looking for a certain set of things for a data warehouse because you want that data. When you run a transaction, you want it to automatically be updated. You can think about anything from school databases where you're doing grades all the way through financial services organizations that are, you know, updating, you know, transactions on a day-to-day basis. You need that to happen really fast. And ACID transactions are basically, you know, this paradigm where they're saying, all right, in order for us to trust, you know, the data, the transaction, we need to have a couple of different things. We need it to be atomic, consistent, reliable, and durable. So that's what an ACID transaction is. And it really speaks to database transactions that would happen in a traditional, you know, data warehouse versus a content store like Azure ADLS or AWS S3 bucket. I talked about content. I talked about metadata. Databricks has something called a data lakehouse, which is basically a combination between a data warehouse and a data lake. Data lakes store, they can store anything, really. Data lake can store content and metadata. But the point is that now they've combined this paradigm of data warehouses and content stores, brought it together, and now you have something called a data lakehouse. So it's really, really fascinating because the data lakehouse has ACID types of transactions that are being utilized on the content that's stored inside of the data warehouse. So you got like the data warehouse ACID transactions, you've got the content and you put it all together, but now you have atomicity, consistency, reliability, as well as durability, all on this content that you're storing in a lakehouse, similar to how you have it on a set of metadata inside of a data warehouse as well.
Why did you move on from Databricks?
I ended up moving on from Databricks and I took a position, the director of data science at Maxar Technologies. Before I started my own company, I was responsible for helping organizations understand their internal kind of data science ecosystem and, you know, figuring out opportunities for increasing efficiency and optimization internally for some of the internal capabilities, but also from an external perspective, really helping grow the data science business.
So what kind of company was it? Was it a government contracting company?
Correct, yes. So Maxar Technologies is a federal government space infrastructure and kind of federal services company.
Man, you've really worked with all kinds of data, huh?
Oh, yes.
The only thing you don't seem to specialize in right now is Word documents or language translation.
Yeah.
healthcare, you got the time series data, you got the SIGINT data, you got the cyber data, you got the modeling of risks. And did you go to Maxar specifically because you thought you wanted to start a company?
To your point, I had a lot of the traditional kind of SIGINT background and knowledge and understanding of vast NLP background, natural language processing background, considering all the different types of data that you would see from an NSA perspective. But what I didn't have was, you think about the geospatial data and the imagery, being able to analyze and process geospatial imagery data. That was a weakness of mine. So, you know, going into a Maxar, I was able to really gain those skills that will enable me to really start my own company by combining capabilities that could take models either from natural language processing or models that dealt with computer vision and figuring out how to integrate those into applications.
I have this image of you like Super Mario, like running around and adding these like coins or special packs, like keep adding you up and beefing you up. So now you're like at level 5 to keep going forward.
Right. Awesome.
Did you have to move to Virginia for that job?
Yes. Right now I'm in Arlington, Virginia. So I moved from the Fort Meade area, Odington, to Arlington, Virginia with that job.
And are you still doing that job?
Yeah. So I left Maxar and I went to, you know, start my own company, AI Squared, full time. You know, we are about 6 months into a company that, you know, I originally started on the side as, you know, something that, you know,
classic was, entrepreneur.
right. You know, started on the side, something that, you know, was just an idea that I had that I was working in my spare time. And I ended up talking to some individuals that, you know, did investing on the Silicon Valley side of the house. And, you know, we were blessed enough to get funded. And, you know, right now we're really still in stealth mode. So I'm not going to say too much until we really kind of have the press release that pushes out the amount of funding that we received, as well as, you know, the actual organization that provided us with the funding. So that is coming. So stay tuned for that. But right now we're in stealth mode and we're really just kind of building the business, building our product market fit, and really showing that we can start to do business on the industry side of the house.
How long is your runway? Done this, right? I did it the other way, where it's like slow and steady, do services, try to build up a little register. So are you watching the burn rate, or you have someone helping you that? Like, are you freaked out? Are you like every day is getting closer to some date?
Yeah. So we've got about 14 employees and
that's a high burn rate.
Yeah. It's a high burn rate. Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but you know, we've got a good chunk of runway. So we're budgeted for, you know, 3+ years and
God damn. Yeah. What is that called? Series B, Series A? What was that? Or just one and done?
Yeah, so this was our first round of funding.
How many places did you have to go with like your empty bag before you hit it?
Oh man, yeah, it's, you know, believe it or not, we were really fortunate because we didn't pitch a lot. And the reason for it was because we were kind of like you, Ms. Cosgrove, we were going to bootstrap and, you know, really kind of take the technology and organically grow it. But what happened was, is that, you know, we wanted to scale a little bit because we had, you know, a set of employees and we were looking to go from, you know, just, you know, working on one project to really figuring out if there's a product market fit in industry. So what we ended up doing was is we pitched specifically a couple of times, and you know, after probably 5 pitches, we ended up getting funded.
That's amazing. Now, are you pre-revenue? Do you have a working product? Do you have clients? Where are you in that stage?
So we do have 3 customers right now. 2 are under NDA, so I won't say who those are, but one of them is Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab.
Oh, nice.
They're paying for our AI Square technology to help them integrate models into the workflows of their analysts and their researchers.
How exciting. You're used to being the tech nerd, and now you're the face, whining and dining, taking care of everybody, setting strategic direction. Has that been quite an adjustment?
I knew I wanted to, at some point, start a company So, you know, I prepared for that. One of the beneficial programs I was a part of was the NSF I-Corps program. And at George Washington, I went through two NSF I-Corps programs. And really, the technology that I was able to incubate as far as the idea really started with the funding. NSF I-Corps program gives you $50,000 in order for you to figure out if there's a product market fit at a small level. The, you know, seed funding from a VC, Silicon Valley VC, is product market fit on steroids, but the $50,000 was your first taste of doing customer discoveries to understand their pain points and see if you can figure out if your technology, number one, they'd be willing to pay for it, and number two, if it would help solve some of those problems that they're having in that organization. So my kind of initial taste went through that a couple of times. It's like a mini MBA in a sense, and you know, really learn what it would actually take to start a company, right? And be able to go out and find a product market fit and incubate a technology so that you can build a product that you could, you know, market to organizations.
Well, I could keep you here all day because I could really nerd out with you and learn. You're a little bit more advanced on the latest tech than I am, since I'm on the inside all the time, as you said. But I want to ask you a couple questions. What advice would you give your younger self?
Advice I would give, it's all about habits. If you're saying that you want to do something and achieve something, you know, I always ask my nephews and, you know, younger individuals that are interested in, you know, having high levels of success, like, what are your habits? What kind of habits do you have? Like, are you doing something every day that can help you get towards your goals? Whether that's getting into a program, you know, putting in energy and effort towards going through a coding boot camp or whatever that may be. If you have the right habits where you're building up towards that goal and you're putting in the time and the energy and effort day after day after day, and it's all about hours. Malcolm Gladwell wrote about the 10,000 hour rule, right? So essentially, if you're putting in those hours and you're building them up, there's nothing that can stop you from that success that you want.
That's great. We actually just picked the book, Atomic Habits, for the Nyla Book Club. It talks a lot about the negative habits can build up to be a big problem. And it's kind of those little things that make a big change over time. What does success look like for you? You've had so many successes so far, right? And you've really hit the goals. What is your big dream, that comfort that you made it?
I want to have a certain level of impact on society, right? So it's not money driven or money oriented. It's really, how can I leave my mark for the next generation of Ben Harveys that come from similar backgrounds, face similar challenges? How can I take the experiences and the knowledge of navigating through some of these challenges and make it easier for that next generation to be successful?
Please tell me about your favorite book, either personal or professional, and what kind of impact it had on you.
One is Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, because he talks about that 10,000 hour rule. And it just comes down to habits. That mastery level, when you think about chess players and the time and energy that they put in to becoming that grandmaster, that's indicative of everyday life for anybody that wants to be successful in, you know, a career. You have to put in those hours, but you can't get to those hours without daily habits, right? So that's why that's important. So I'll throw that one out there. I'll throw out one other one, Trillion Dollar Coach. It was written by Alan Eagle, was the main author, but it talks about this guy, Bill Campbell, who's like a Silicon Valley legend for coaching. And he coached Apple. He worked with Google. He always was focused on, you know, helping organizations understand the lessons that he had as a coach, because he was a coach at Columbia, and helping them understand the lessons that he had as a coach and how they could apply them to the business world. He's got these strategies in there that could help, you know, any startup or any organization.
Tell me something about yourself that might surprise us.
When I was in college and I played basketball, our basketball team went and played in the NCAA tournament. And the team that we played was UCLA. And at that time, UCLA had Kevin Love and Russell Westbrook, who are both in the NBA right now. And they beat our school, Mississippi Valley State, by like 60 points in that tournament game. And I always tell my kids that when they have kids and I'm able to talk to my grandkids, I'll say, hey, when Mississippi Valley State played UCLA in the tournament, dad was there or your grandpa was there. And I didn't play, I didn't score that game, but I'll tell my grandkids that I scored 30 points and I'll tell my great grandkids that I was MVP of the tournament.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. Please be sure to share it with friends and family. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under the Outspoken Podcast. Thanks again, and chin up, heads up, eyes forward.